All right, so welcome everyone. I'm Alexa, and I'm here today to talk about black market innovation and frugal innovation coming from the informal economies. Since we have an amazingly small group, I think it would be wonderful to start out and just really get a sense from you guys why you're here, what interest you have in this topic, and just rapid fire sort of quick introductions so I can really frame some of my comments more to why you're here and the kinds of discussion that you want to have. But really, by way of background, I kicked off this research last fall, and so really have just been exploring cutting-edge innovation coming from the underground. And so looking at all kinds of innovations outside of Silicon Valley, but really understanding, you know, what informal innovators are doing around property rights, what Somali pirates are doing around price discovery. I was recently in Rwanda and also just looked at informal justice systems that were arising. So I have more of a background coming from the social entrepreneurship space, where a lot of innovations in emerging economies, you know, upwards of 70% of certain countries are happening in the informal sector. And so really just looking at innovation outside of the mainstream and asking, you know, what can we learn from this? And also, what's the future of informal innovation? Is it here to stay? Is it something that is really going to be swallowed up by the formal sector? And so what are some of the challenges in informal innovation actually mainstreaming? I know you're on your phone, so maybe that's inappropriate to start with you. But if you just want to quickly introduce yourself and also just say, you know, what sorts of expectations you brought to this topic.
I'm Ronald. I'm from the Netherlands, actually. And the reason I came from this to this session is the first time I got interested in innovation in the black market is when I looked at illegally downloading music online. So you have the proper online shops, the iTunes, etc. And then I looked at another store called All of MP3. It's a Russian site. It wasn't exactly legal. And you look at the differences. iTunes offers you one type of download. It's locked down. There's DRM on it, and you can't really use it the way you want to. And you go to the illegal store. They offer you a variety of formats you can download at any bit rate that you want, and once you have it, you can use it on any device that you own. So, and I was thinking, I would pay good money to have legal access to this sort of experience, really. And I'm curious if there are other analogies or other instances in the world out there where we can learn from what the people on the black market are doing.
Hi, everyone. I'm Carrie. I run a company called FutureGov in the UK. We work with local government to help them change the way they deliver public services and that kind of stuff. I'm really just like interested in examples of stuff that's going on there, and I kind of like to bring those into government and sort of shake that stuff up a bit.
Hi, I'm Steve. I work in product innovation at Netflix, and we compete with the informal economy quite a bit, so I'm interested to and all the topics, really. So.
Hi, I'm Chris. I guess I'm an activist, and I'm interested in resistance to the dominant systems and how this might play into that.
Hi, I'm Olivia, and I work in social enterprise as well. And I'm interested in the reapplication of certain types of models and systems, and also looking at, the counterculture ways to do things, which I think in many cases are more effective.
I'm Tim, and I work actually with Alexa, and I'm very much interested in all the things that she's pursuing outside of most of the stuff we work together on. So this is a fascinating topic, and I'm totally, totally hooked.
Hi, I'm Natalie. I'm from New York. I work in advertising as a strategist. And I guess what I came to hear about today was, looking at any kind of innovation and these like the first to do anything and how to read that. And so coming at it a different angle through something like social entrepreneurship, I thought was really interesting. So,
Hi, I'm Scott. I'm a coworker of Natalie. I read an article in Wired about an interview with Robert Neuwirth, and that kind of really intrigued me because of how he quantified the scale of these kind of black market economies and how they're just gigantic in comparison to like GDPs of nations. And I'd never considered that before. And I work on behalf of brands, which is interesting because you don't want to like co-opt what's happening naturally, but to understand the system and how it works and how you could get cues from that is what's interesting to me.
Hi, I'm Catherine Ryan. I'm with GovLab, a public sector innovation think tank within Deloitte, and I'm looking for new ideas for some of my research, so I thought I'd come here.
Hello, I'm Christian Benedetto. I am an innovation director at Adidas, and I am interested in the sparks and culture of innovation.
Hi, I'm Sunil Paul. And I've just calculated that at this rate, we will consume 40 minutes of the hour on introductions. I'm going to model a faster introduction. So let me start again. I'm not doing it yet.
That was
an intervention, right? Here's my introduction. I'm Sunil Paul. I'm an investor. My question is, how do my companies be iTunes instead of Napster?
I'm Andrea. I'm with an ad agency here in Austin, GSDNM, and I'm just very fascinated with the premise, and it's my role at the agency to bring new thinking and to understand the different dynamics that are happening.
I'm Julian. I'm from an advertising agency, and the same thing, looking for new examples.
I'm Noel. I'm from New York. I'm just interested in how cultures and people adapt to existing technology to really fine-tune it for exactly what they want it to do.
I'm Peter. I work in advertising as a creative. I hate advertising panels, but this just seemed like a really interesting kind of different take on digital innovation. So,
Andy, work in advertising, strategist, and yeah, I'm too hungover to really contribute much.
I'm Steve, I'm from an agency in London, and I'm here to see what innovation looks like with no accountability.
I'm Brian. I guess I represent artist rights or artist advocacy, and I'm just curious if the black market actually can be co-opted. Thanks.
I'm Mark. I'm in retail, primarily QSR and convenience store space, just trying to understand where the next innovations are coming from.
I'm Raja, San Francisco designer. Just came here as a topic of interest.
I'm Talif, UI engineer, coworker of Raja's, and I'm here just to see what we're talking about.
I'm Chris. I'm from Canada. I'm here because I love questioning authority, and I guess also I lived in Indonesia for a bit, and I saw lots of child prostitution, and that upsets me.
Jason, development manager. Just here from Mountain View and curious about the examples, yeah.
Fletcher from Rebelhold. Just here because I feel like the black market economies and that sort of thing really push the envelope and are where like the next new big ideas come from.
Sam Robertson, nonprofit here in Austin, Texas, looking for new ways of raising funds.
Christopher, I work for Mint Digital in New York, and you know, we're interested in new models of innovation and how we can possibly apply that to what we do.
I'm David Creekmore. I'm with Internews, a nonprofit in D.C., a foreign assistance media development nonprofit that seeks to help local media organizations in a developing world find sustainable models and be innovative. So.
Hi, guys. I'm Freya Zahir. I'm a second-year student at HBS, and I think this is the most fascinating topic at South by Southwest. I think this is where the ideas of the future are going to come from, so we should be paying attention.
She's a Hi, I'm Judy. I work in media. I'm interested in new platforms, innovation.
Wonderful. Great. So it sounds like we have a lot of diversity here in the room, and recently I just wanted to provide a bit of context. I was talking about this a few weeks ago at a panel at Harvard, actually, and the whole conversation was around access to medicines. And I brought some of this thinking into that conversation, saying, what if we could deliver access and use some of the distribution channels from the informal economy, from the black market, to actually transform how drug access is delivered in emerging economies. And that provided some interesting fodder for the panelists to think about specifically something called Mira. So I was in Kenya a month ago, and Mira is, for those not familiar with their amphetamines, it's a drug not entirely like cocaine that you actually chew, and it's most notoriously associated with Somali communities across the world. And it's located, it's harvested at the base of Mount Kenya. And they have the most incredible distribution systems all over the world. You can get Mira in Heathrow Airport in the UK in 24 hours. While, the US government couldn't fly helicopters into Somalia, you could get Mira in Somalia. The Mira traders were still running. So something like that and the power of some of these distribution channels, their speed and efficacy, I think was just a really interesting way to rethink some of the questions around access to drugs and that debate. And then really the second story is a lot of this topic I came to really through a sense of humor and, really through a tongue-in-cheek kind of exploration. I met this New Yorker cartoonist, and I pitched him one summer this idea saying, you really need to do this cartoon about terrorists. And he's like, okay. And then I said, okay, so I want you to show terrorists going green. I think it's really important to show that terrorists can go green. And so I wanted him to draw this cartoon showing terrorists being concerned with their carbon offset programs. And I suggested to him that he could even have McKinsey consultants in the cartoon doing some of the carbon footprinting work for the terrorists. And he said, that's a horrible idea. I'm not going to do that. And that wouldn't work for the New Yorker. But I still feel like, coming from a liberal arts education, I think we too often other so many of the different kinds of, people, personalities, communities out there. And I think it's really interesting coming to this topic just to see the sheer breadth of innovation that a lot of these communities that we think of as evil or as scary or that we just don't interact with on a daily basis, how they actually have some insights or have a humanity that can really inform what we do. So here's innovation from some more unlikely suspects. We're going to be exploring a few brands that maybe you guys haven't heard of. The Latin Kings is a notorious gang. They like to see themselves more as a cultural institution. Camel Milk. I have some wonderful friends who study the camel milk trade internationally. Anyone from sort of traders in northern Kenya to even Amish. They have the Amish in the U.S. have actually been arrested for engaging in the camel milk trade. Clearly there are a number of brands that are pure up copycat brands. Waste Ventures is actually a whole way in which the waste picker industry in a lot of emerging economies have actually become formalized. And so between 50 to 75% of waste and recycling programs actually in emerging economies actually come from some of the waste picker industries that got started in the informal sector. I think it's also important to note, while we're having fun exploring some of these themes, as someone suggested in the introduction, in no way is this endorsing black market innovation, but really just cataloging some of those innovations that I've come across and some ways that I think people are being incredibly effective in the work that they do. So the project for me really has started off just in groups like this, collecting stories from people who I know. And so I was recently in Lisbon presenting, and this guy who sold marijuana in university came up to me and said, oh, this is fantastic. I used to be a hacker and I used to be a drug dealer, and now I'm taking a lot of those insights from that work and actually applying them to launch a totally legal caffeine stimulant drug using the entire network that I built through my college pot dealing business, basically. So I thought that was really interesting to think about how you can sort of float in between some of these spaces. We also, with my co-author and I, will have a book coming out next year. So this is also your opportunity for you guys to help shape some of how we're coming at this research, to tell us and contribute some of your own stories, and also to voice some of those concerns. I'll just be really speaking to a few points today, really laying the context for this. Exploring some of the concrete archetypes or different kinds of personas or actors that we see within this overall banner of misfit economy, and then really getting into more of a discussion with you around some of the best practices and insights we see coming out. I think someone mentioned Robert Neuwirth's book, Stealth of Nations. This has been making a big splash in Fast Company and Wired. But there's also a number of other books and scholars who are committed to this space. Jew God Innovation is fantastic. It's from a bunch of Cambridge researchers. They've got they blog regularly at HBR. And they're really looking at how you can actually take informal economy and lessons from the informal economy and apply them in a corporate setting. So they're dealing with multinationals and thinking about co-option very directly. Another thing that I wanted to mention was just Makeshift Magazine. Absolutely fantastic updates from the field. It's a guy who's here at South by Southwest. Steve Daniels, a good friend of mine, who runs this magazine, and they get contributions from people all over the world who are exploring some of the innovations coming out of the black market and informal economy. I think we mentioned, you know, someone mentioned earlier just the size, but if we really think about what the informal markets mean today, it's a $10 trillion economy. So it's really the second largest economy behind the U.S. And so that's just massive when you think about these markets and also think about the innovation coming out of these markets. I mentioned this briefly, and this is, I went to Brown University with a few other people here, and so spend my whole time there studying cultural theory and have a need to somehow justify that by bringing at least one slide into my everyday work. But, you know, really just thinking about through history, there's a great historian that writes about deviance in history and so looks at anything from pirates and how pirates set the foundation for global capital markets to vagabonds, you know, vagabonds in the UK, vagabonds in the eastern United States during the colonial era, who were actually, you know, vital sources of innovation and were very helpful in the ways in which innovation got spread. And so I think the more that we see these people less defined by what they're not and more defined by, you know, what they are and what the ways in which they are actually innovating, I think that's really critical. Some famous misfits from history. I am not going to talk about Gandhi, but I think, you know, Joan of Arc is an interesting case right now because she's being co-opted by the French government and by both parties of the French government, and she's perhaps one of the most famous historical misfits who was totally, you know, born awkwardly out of her time. I don't know if she could have existed in any time period, actually. But, you know, interesting to see how, you know, centuries and centuries later, she's become a symbol for French nationalists. Tesla also a sort of adversary of Thomas Edison. He was a total misfit from you know, he had immense psychological phobias. He spoke to pigeons, and yet he was one of the innovators that really made electricity as we know it today entirely possible. And you don't often hear about him, but he was really the guy that made Thomas Edison. I think if you think about the kinds of rivals that have plagued a lot of mainstream innovators, there's always someone more in the shadows who is pushing them on, and that competitive dynamic can be incredibly helpful. So these are some of the archetypes that we've developed to talk about the misfit economy more generally. The first one that we talk about is really the unseen. And this person is someone that operates in the informal economy. They're really motivated by frugality. They have this concern with survival, stability, livelihood. And people like this, you know, you see them as pioneering innovative methods around, you know, squatter rights, around sort of illegal worker kinds of programs. I was recently in Kenya, as I mentioned, and was in Kibera, and there were a number of unseen innovators working in Kibera who had some incredible informal systems. So anything from electric and water supply services to local justice courts. The other funny thing about this slum in Nairobi, it's one of the biggest slums, and every other block of the slum is colonized by a different NGO. So I think when you think about sort of turf wars that happen with gangs, I think it was really interesting for me to see the way in which Kibera and slums in general play to this kind of NGO need for this exotica. And, you know, really a lot that is actually transforming Kibera is just local innovators who are working there and who have less to do with the sort of neo-imperialist ambitions of a lot of the NGOs. The second archetype we developed was around this concept of the gangster. And we based this basically off of episodes of The Wire initially until we actually had enough interviews done. But I was speaking to someone who was part of the Latin Kings recently, and he just really told me some fantastic stories about thinking around gangs as cultural institutions and thinking about the role that they played in terms of, you know, creating communities, as well as, you know, specifically this story of how he was in a gang in Puerto Rico, in Nieta, which is a prison there. And one of the most successful ways that they went about innovating in that prison was to develop their entirely own self-regulating policing system. And so they did that by basically having these protests and getting the guards to recognize the rules that they wanted to play by. So it was an enormous effort at self-governance within prisons, and it's one that now the formal economy is looking to, saying, okay, how can we actually get prisons to function more effectively by having crowdsourced prisoner feedback around the kinds of rules or principles that should be part of prison life. I think another thing to mention that was kind of funny was just thinking about recruitment and retention of gangs. And so this fellow I spoke to, you know, really spoke to the ways in which he was given a place in history by this gang, that he was given a cultural identity that he didn't, you know, doesn't have. And whenever he, you know, this gang is all over Latin America, whenever he meets anyone else in this gang, that's the identity that comes first. And so it really exceeds any sense of nation state boundaries. In terms of the Somali pirates, it's funny, I'm part of this network called the Sandbox Network, and it's for young entrepreneurs under 30. And it's a running joke that you can basically post in the Facebook group and get a connection to anyone, anywhere in the world, from sort of Bono to anyone's, you know, grandmother. But we posted the other day wanting a connection to Somali pirates, and within like 2 hours we'd gotten 3 different people who said they could introduce us. But, you know, have read a lot about Somali pirates, and Wired has done a few articles as well, but really looking at the business model of Somali pirates, there's a stock exchange, for example, recently that's been customized around investing in piracy in Somalia, and it's just such a mainstream industry there. There's also interesting techniques of negotiation, you know, that lawyers, you know, we sort of joke about this tongue in cheek, but, you know, looking at the kinds of price discovery that has emerged in some of those markets, I think just fascinating. The next archetype, which a lot of you in this room will be familiar with, is the hacker. This isn't one that I want to dwell on terribly, but I think, you know, it's a really interesting intersection to see sort of what gets to become black market or gray market innovation and what is actually legal. And so I think there's a lot of contestation in this space, particularly as it relates to the hacker. And a lot of you may have seen just this the other day, but I think it really, you know, shows the point. Who defines what is deviant behavior? And what is acceptable, and who defines what is illegal, and how does that happen? And I think we all have to remember that it is a cultural dialogue that takes place, that we shape what constitutes deviance, basically. Another archetype that we've pursued, and we're going to be doing a lot of research around in China, is really the copycat. And This is an archetype that I first came into contact with when I was working with GSK, actually, the large pharmaceutical company. And GSK was basically pissed off that all these people in emerging markets were stealing their drugs and charging absolutely nothing for them and giving them to poor people all over the world who needed essential drug therapies. And so we had a series of conversations with large pharmaceutical companies about, you know, generics and about some of the folks that were infringing on their IP. And, you know, as a result, after years of, you know, nearly 10 years of legal battles with a lot of these copycat innovators, these mainstream pharmaceutical companies finally began to slash their prices. So finally developed pricing models that were actually inspired by, you know, quote unquote enemies, people that they saw as actually being incredibly disruptive to their businesses. Another story that I heard recently is actually a friend of mine who was a consultant, and he was investigating productivity problems in China. And he went to a series of factories that were underperforming, and he found, after speaking to some people, he inquired as to why he thought they were underperforming. And one guy basically, you know, refused to talk to him there, but met him after the factory closed that evening and basically said, look, we're all getting on this other bus. We're being taken 30 miles away, and we're working in an identical factory with the same labor force. Everything's been copied from this formal factory, and it's basically been modeled after this multinational. So basically, all these copycat factories in China were producing the exact same thing. We're using the exact same labor force. The labor force would work through the evening, and it was just funny that it was this management consultant who was the one to uncover that. The agitator, I think, for those of you who are activists in the room, I think this is really interesting, just to think about the pace of innovation. And so certainly the art of protest is something that has been around for thousands of years, but how much has that actually evolved? I was speaking and working, you know, with someone quite closely in the UK who started off as a protester protesting pharmaceutical companies. And she worked for groups like Oxfam. She worked to develop, you know, patent pools on the outside. And she's actually evolved her model today. So rather than being, you know, the sort of protester that you see really represented from, you know, the 80s kind of symbolic anti-corporate protester that maybe was epitomized in Seattle, she's now taken a very different tactic, which is she's protesting through large pension funds. She is she's working with large pension funds and figuring out how she can get them to entirely change multinational behavior. So working on anything from human rights to access to medicines, to access to energy, to reducing oil dependency. And I think, you know, this model, when you actually bring investors into the room, and when you get investors to put pressure on companies to change their behavior, it can be incredibly effective. So looking at just the ways in which people are developing innovative models towards protests, certainly we've seen this, you know, recently with Arab Spring and Occupy, and probably a number of you in the audience have things to share on that account. But I was speaking to someone in Egypt, in Cairo, actually, who was basically a social entrepreneur, an innovator who was working to develop something to report on traffic within Cairo. And he leveraged that innovation to bring about a lot of support and efficiencies to Arab Spring. People began to report on where political outbursts were happening within Cairo, on where different communities could go to for support, and just report on general activities of where protest was happening. And so that was something where, you know, so much of what's happening in terms of building social movements now, I think people are finding ways to get out of their day jobs and repurpose a lot of the infrastructure and the technology they have towards, you know, bigger things, towards bigger movements. The provocateur is one of the other archetypes we've developed. It's perhaps the most hard to really distill some of those best practices, but this basically is, you know, it's the graffiti artist. It's people like the Yes Men. It's people that make a fuss about things that shock and provoke us, that make us uncomfortable. I did a lot of study of language poets back at university, and really just looking at how innovations in how we use language. I remember the first lesson we were taught at a seminar was basically write poetry, but you can't use any of these words. And the words were things like love, flower, tree, you know, generic things that people used to write really bad poetry. And so the kinds of language experiments that we undertook through that was just phenomenal in creating entirely new languages, both for ourselves and for the people in that workshop. And I think this is incredibly important too, and has just been a skill that I've used today that comes from this really countercultural movement of poetry, in which a lot of these folks have made, you know, absolutely no sense. And then to begin to think about how you apply that within a corporate context. If you work in an organization that is full of jargon, and you know, sad enough to say, even the social entrepreneurship sector has quite a bit of that. I think it's, how do you disrupt some of that language? How do you begin to speak in a more authentic way? And I think the provocateur has a lot of insights for us in terms of how we can do that. The last archetype that we began exploring was the one around the zealot, or basically looking at different orthodox groups that were motivated by truth, capital T. And so looking at these groups, which were painted really in an extremist fashion, but yet have done some incredibly interesting kinds of innovations and have also sustained over time. Just the nature of religious institutions are some that have co-evolved with human psychology for thousands of years. Certainly they have to have something to teach us about innovation and how that works. And so when I was in Kenya recently, I spoke to this guy that had been a business school student, and he's now tasked with something incredible to me. He's tasked with building mega churches, and he's taking all his business school thinking in terms of organizational strategy, in terms of marketing, in terms of consumer insights, and he's applying that to these mega churches and thinking about how you actually, you know, create and grow these communities. I was interested in talking to him because I just think that's a fantastic premise for a piece of fiction that I would like to write. But getting more in terms of the debate around co-option, I think, you know, looking at some of these innovators, there are a number of insights that we can begin to see happening. I think first and foremost, there's this notion of really effective free riding. And free riding, I think the Gates Foundation talks about this a lot in terms of just using, for example, healthcare delivery systems should just use Coca-Cola distribution networks, which is a horrible idea for various reasons. But in this context, it's really interesting. It's thinking how can you actually develop and repurpose some of the distribution networks that people in the informal economy, people in black markets use for your benefit. The other one is really just around rapid prototyping, and I think you see this mostly in the archetype around copycat culture, but looking at the ways in which people, you know, cell phones, for example, the notion of the removable SIM or the dual SIM, I think you've seen ways in which copycats, people that have taken technologies, have broken them down and then have repurposed them, have just do prototyping at a speed that most people in mainstream industry can't beat. The other thing I think is really important is that as we're moving towards more of an era of cultural capitalism is movement building. How do you, you know, Nike has done a lot of this kind of work, but how do you think about your brand as a social movement? And this is something that I think, you know, the agitator or the archetype of the agitator has done successfully with things like Occupy. But what is it about movement building that we can take, and what is it about this feeling of being part of something bigger that's really important? I think most consumers don't want to feel like consumers, and as we develop a form of capitalism that is a bit more discreet, I think thinking about radical mobilization, you know, even pop-up architecture that's happening that that took from a lot of the innovations being pioneered by provocateurs and by street artists, or interesting ways in which corporate brands are engaging in this. Another really interesting best practice, I think, is just around the sustainability agenda more broadly. So looking at alternative theories of consumption from, you know, reuse and recycling kinds of programs that are being pioneered by waste pickers, to totally common space networks for thinking about property rights. I think if you just look at the flagrant consumption of resources that we have in society today, companies are going to have to find massively innovative ways of reducing their footprint. And so a lot of these innovators are incredibly frugal, incredibly scrappy with materials, and have a lot to teach us about sort of end use product life cycle kind of management and things like that. So this is really then to begin to explore how do we begin to think about this spirit infecting all of our day jobs? What can we do to feel like tempered radicals, to feel like social entrepreneurs within companies? How do we begin to innovate with this spirit in mind? Normally, when I speak to corporate clients, I'm talking about two waves of innovation, and really getting these companies to plot where they are in terms of, do they feel like they're declining, or how do they make experiments or bets in riding the next wave of innovation? And so I think the misfit innovators that we're profiling actually have a lot to teach our clients, both in terms of anticipating some of those new waves, but also as a way of animating and enchanting clients that might be more in this decline. It's funny, I was recently with a large energy company and was basically doing a workshop for them around their renewable energy business. And their renewable energy business within the company effectively feels like a group of conspirators within a big energy company. They feel like protesters. They're trying to drive a vision for decarbonization that no one else in the company buys. And so the kind of consulting support that we offered to them was around language, for one. How do you develop different language profiles depending on who you speak with? What's the right language to use with your corporate host? What's the right language to use with external stakeholders? And what's the right language to actually for you to stay true to the vision? And I think the task of people like this, the task of social entrepreneurs, people within companies that feel like they have more of this conspirator kind of role, or that feel like they're trying to bring things like social impact and business opportunity together, are really struggling with this sense of a misfit identity. And so we're developing, through some of my work at Ashoka, we're actually developing networks to support these kinds of people and to give rise to more guerrilla innovation happening with companies, something we're calling corporate social revolution. This is an obligatory quote by Einstein that I will not read. but some of the issues in terms of the art of co-opting, it was funny. I was at in Boston a few weeks ago, and this guy came up to me and he said, "So I'm working on informality. He knows a lot about Ashoka, and he also happens to be a cousin of mine from this really small town in Missouri, and he basically wants to throw a conference around informality. And so the challenge in throwing this conference is how much can you actually formalize informality, and who would actually be attending this conference, and what are the dangers of actually getting mainstream institutions to co-opt some of this innovation, to borrow the authenticity from a lot of these innovators for their own purposes. I think, certainly some people feel a certain degree of mission drip or co-option. So what's the right balance for that? And that's what I wanted to focus our discussion on. I mean, I think the benefit of having a smaller group and having all of you guys in the room and sharing some of your expectations today is really just to probe this. What are some of your stories? What are some of the insights that you feel like we can learn from misfit innovation, from your daily work? And also, how are you trying to apply this to some of the organizations that you work in. How do you do culture change? How do you feel like you are a conspirator, you know, within your organizations? To what extent does this resonate for you? Is this part of, you know, what you see as your mission at hand? So I'll really turn it over to you guys. I'll put the microphone here and, or just pass it around. But, you know, feel free to share your story.
Pretty much my whole question.
What's your question?
Like teens versus young adults, like how are they operating differently within the same sort of
yeah.
So I guess I have an example and a question, and I've been thinking a lot about this, participating in the Occupy Seattle movement over the fall, and in Seattle, it's this history of activism is pretty prevalent because of the protests in 1999. And in the late 90s, with the Global Justice Movement, they developed the Indie Media Center, which was a network of alternative news on the web. And I really have been thinking about that. I really think that predated blogging in a big way, and kind of paved the way for this more syndicated, updated content. And then I've been thinking now with the Occupy movement and this new wave of U.S. activism, not that there hasn't been other movements for the last 10 years, but what are the innovations that are happening now? And I think in the way with the, they're building, rapidly building an infrastructure that's both, that's very new in the terms of it is decentralized and there's a lack of ownership, and they're building websites where different people, like, where there's mass administration and everyone has a bit of ownership and control. And I think it's going to be really interesting what that leads to over the next year or two. Oh, and my question is, what strategies do these groups have to resist co-option? I think every one of those archetypes has a stake in not being co-opted, and some have a direct stake in toppling over some of the co-opters. So what would be those strategies that you've seen deployed?
Great. I mean, I think both of your comments, I would almost answer your question with your comment, in the sense that I think if there's something generational that is distinct about Misfit Innovators, I really think it is this movement-based approach. And I think it is, you know, to your point around decentralization. I think, you know, many have painted the next generation as one that's incredibly civically conscious. And I think that's true from, you know, the gang members that I've spoken to the Occupy protesters that I've met, to people that are working in informal economies. And so I think there is this need to focus on the bigger picture and to maximize societal welfare. And that's more, that's an identity. I think it's, you know, when we talk about movement building at Ashoka, we talk about it in three phases. The first is the need to create a call to action around a core identity that can bring diverse people from various practices and give you a banner under which to weave all these different fields together. The second piece is around accountability, or beginning to create a sort of transactional infrastructure, and just really the importance that people can share skills, can ask one another to do things. The third thing that we talk about is really sustainability, so how you plan for a bigger infrastructure in that space. And so I think so many of the folks that are working on this in our generation just have that movement perspective, and I think it's really hard for them to feel like they are being tied to an institution. You know, they have an identity that doesn't live within institutions, and institutions are only really temporary hosts whose resources you may be able to pillage for a certain amount of time. So I think just, you know, radically different approach to that.
Hi, so I sometimes think about, like, what the best parts of, you know, what you mentioned are. And I think about this time I went through the Indonesian border and I didn't have a visa and I bribed the guy and it was, like, so efficient. It was fabulous. It was just, like, it was great. And a lot of these innovations kind of get at efficiency in the short run, right, between individuals within like this kind of immediate time horizon. But then you think about like, you know, how they actually bring the system down over a longer time horizon or in a more macro context. So when the playing field is not level, some of these innovations then turn and actually, you know, lead to less innovation because people feel like the cards are stacked against them. You know, there's not a level playing field, so how can I compete? So why innovate? I'm just wondering how you kind of like, if you've seen that in your research state and sort of how you're negotiating like time frames and individuals versus kind of the more macro long-term sphere.
I think the bribing example is perfect because you can see how that is incredibly efficient within a short time horizon, but then also doesn't allow for long-term sustainability. And we recently at Changemakers through Ashoka had a competition around citizen media, and there was an incredible innovation that came out around bribing and around sort of the long-term benefits.
Sure. It was actually an innovation called the zero rupee note. And essentially what it was just a piece of paper that had the number zero on it. And whereas somebody would traditionally provide, you know, 50, 100 rupees to get something done, they would go through the same exact action except hand them sort of this note, which on the back, you know, described the way that bribery was degrading their society. And then there was a whole sort of online platform to track sort of responses to this and actually just build a movement. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, fascinating example.
What's funny about that, too, is I think it adds more of a prankster kind of spirit, but also reinforces just integrity.
Is there a negative result from this event? Was that actually happening?
Is there more of that?
I mean, I know it was a bit more of an early stage, but it attracted a
lot of attention. Oops, sorry. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was very early stage, and so I think that there, you know, there's some level of skepticism, but I think enough people were drawn to the simplicity of the solution that, you know, it had a lot of potential.
What else? As I go about,
how does something like, forgetting Bitcoin play into this? I mean, that wasn't something that you mentioned that you referenced as one of
the alternative currency and the monetary currency movement is one that we're focused on. And I come at it more from the perspective of the social entrepreneur. So the social currencies that I've been interested in are ones that are based around community resilience approaches, you know, things like time banking. And really looking at, you know, all those great experiments that are happening in little places in the U.S., how do you actually expand some of this stuff? And why, you know, we've been around for 30 years.
Just asking, things like the parallel SIM, where you can co-opt, say, a cell phone for a different environment rather than going with one of the standard locked environments for one of the major companies. Have you seen that a lot? I know that there is a person who's using that in third world countries really to record medical data and track medical data, and it provides a capability to get any phone that's locked and use it in that environment.
Yeah, it's interesting. So a lot of if you go to any country and you bring your cell phone, you can get it unlocked, which I guess is technically illegal. But then now, and that was certainly something that was pioneered by more misfit innovators who were working in the informal sector, but it's now actually standard practice. In Kenya, you can buy phones that allow you to have multiple SIM cards or allow you to unlock your SIM cards. And so that's something that's spun over and come back into mainstream industry. I think that's really interesting. Another sort of funny example is when I was in Kenya working with this, I was speaking to a researcher who was focused on prostitution, and he was focused on tracking HIV and AIDS and the spread of disease, and he was trying to create tools to basically make prostitution safer in a lot of these countries. And he developed this almost this sort of management software tool, so he could begin to see, you know, how many people prostitutes had slept with per day, what sort of the rate at which diseases were being spread. And interestingly, a lot of his subjects, the prostitutes themselves, came back to him and said, how can we use that innovation that you're building to actually to track our clients, basically? How can this be used as a sort of personal diary for us to actually not only do this healthily, but it also has potential to bring efficiencies in terms of our own client engagement. I think he obviously had a moral obligation to say no to that, but I think it is those are the sorts of tensions that you see when you're dealing with some of these markets.
I was just wondering about, so some of these things we try to do with people, like I work with local government in the UK, and we try and employ some of these tactics within the organisation, like with limited success at times, and I just wondered whether these things work because they're outside of formal structures, or whether like inside an organisation which is very hierarchical and structured, even though we're trying to kind of it does work at times, but and we've got some good examples as well, but sometimes a hierarchy just crushes any of these kind of things because they're so fragile, and they're the kind of juggernaut of hierarchy kills them instantly.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've spoken to a lot of people in the UK who do work around co-production as ways of procuring public services, which basically just means that you're working with target beneficiaries as part of the informal citizen sector to actually produce the services themselves. So you would use it, for example, in sort of mental health services, in which, you know, informal caregivers would play a role, or even people that were suffering from mental health issues would actively design those services. And I think that's an interesting step in the right direction for governments to certainly take more responsibility for developing approaches that are really led by citizens and where a citizen initiative is taking place. But then it's also really difficult because certainly in the UK it's used right as a way of actually outsourcing a lot of the work that government is meant to be doing. And so it's a way of justifying budget cuts. For example, if you can get more of the informal economy to do your job for you. But I think massively the kind of citizen engagement that we're seeing informing everything from sort of public services to, you know, corporate brands is certainly a trend that is here to stay, but I don't think we have the right sort of infrastructure designed around it yet. Certainly, there are emerging funders that can play a role in helping set that up. People that are interested more in impact investing, for example. But you know, if someone's not part of an institution, how do they actually sustain that work? And I see this all the time. Even I think the spirit of the hackathon, right, where you bring people together collectively, for example, for a few days, and say they were to design new efficiencies for public service, there's nowhere really after that for that innovation to sit. And so they're actually, we haven't evolved the infrastructure to support more of these informal approaches. But I would be really interested in, do you have thoughts or ways in which we could think about that?
I don't know. Connecting between what people are doing with organizations.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Just about along, and they're kind of just chatting to each other on this back channel, which the government hasn't worked out. Yeah. And it's kind of like just talking about, hey, I saw this, like, I'll probably post some stuff from here on there and say, like, there's some interesting things I can go and have a look at this. People sharing,
yeah.
It's very informal and very helpful. As soon as an IT department finds it, they'll go down and
yeah. And it's like even Tim and I are doing some great work at Ashoka. We're designing a campaign around economic opportunity. A global campaign, and it's really focused on this notion of DIY economy. And we're speaking to upwards of 30, 40 stakeholders. And there's, you know, it's literally sort of, you're talking to them on your phone, you're sitting from the institution that you're at, but you're trying to build this coalition. And aside from an event, like, how can you have all these people playing together? And I just think so much, and this is why, you know, even within an organization like Ashoka, the struggle is to get out of that 9-to-5, you sort of put your card in and take it out when you leave at the end of the day, and where can these people sit? So, you know, things like the hub, I think, are encouraging, but they don't necessarily have the right actors in the room. It's more people that can afford to be social entrepreneurs. But so it's corporate innovation. It's like, how do you design these innovation spaces, I guess? Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great challenge. I don't have good answers for that, but yeah. Okay, wonderful. So, yeah, I think we're basically at time, but thank you guys so much for your feedback, and if you have any additional prods in terms of the direction that some of this research should take, or at you know, good stories that we should focus on in terms of the book, would really appreciate it. But thanks, everyone, for your time.